Hi, I'm David Crow. Welcome back to The Infectious Myth. Thank you for tuning in to episode 59. You can email with me with comments about the show or suggestions for future guests at david.crow, that's Crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message with your mailing address, letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, I will send you a little thank you gift. And if you'd like to support PRN or this show directly, please contact me. Today, I'm here by myself again to talk about freedom of expression. I think it's a whole lot more complicated than you're either in favor of it or against it. Everyone is against some freedom of expression, but a lot of people don't admit that. It's one of those but of course moments, i.e. I'm in favor of all freedom of expression, but of course not that. Anyway, before we get to that subject, let's go through the feedback of the week. The podcast episodes that are being downloaded more than five times a day are episode 51 on long-term non-progressors and episode 52 on the Gulf War Syndrome. Those that are downloaded more than 10 times a day are number 53, which was myself talking about censorship. So maybe this current episode will also be popular. 54, Eric Gladden on the movie Trace Amounts. Episode 55 with Liam Sheff and his novel. And 56, Wallace Thornhill on the Electric Universe. I'm starting to see a bit of a pattern. I think our elite are my... listenership is growing, and that's why it's the more recent episodes that are more popular. So I would just encourage you to go back and listen to some of the old episodes. We're up to number 59 now. So there's a lot of really interesting subjects that I've covered, and probably in the earlier episodes there weren't a lot of people that listened. But there's nothing stopping you from going back and picking out a few of the old ones that you'd like to listen to, or download them all onto your MP3 player, and if you're on a long road trip or something like that, start listening to them. Anyway, here's a feedback. Oh, pardon me. The overall winner in downloads is episode number 46 on nuclear power with Helen Caldicott, who has been a world... a very famous opponent of nuclear power and, of course, nuclear weapons for many years. Here's some feedback from Ivet Flexen via Facebook. Hello, Mr. Crow. I've enjoyed your radio show very much. In your first episode, you hinted at viruses not being what science claims they are. I ran across this interview, and he sent me a YouTube clip, but not found much else on the subject. If you find time in your schedule, please listen and share your thoughts. I think you'll find it interesting if you haven't already. Have a great day. Well, Ivet, thanks for your feedback, and I really do appreciate these things. I might not follow up on them right away, but I will. And if it appears that there's a subject for an interview, I may very well contact somebody so that we can expand the topics that we've covered. So, freedom of expression. The latest craze of expression, if you can call it that, is the FHITP phenomenon, which translates to effer in the pisser. You all know the F word, and I assume that pisser is a crude word for a woman's urethra. The game, if you can call it that, is to find a woman reporter ready to tape an interview and then run up to the microphone and yell the phrase while, hopefully, she's on the air. The game is usually played by somewhat inebriated young men, and the victims are always women. Because of YouTube, I guess this was televised or photographed a few times, because of YouTube this has gone viral, as you might say. A lot of young men, especially when they've had a few too many, think it's really funny and go and do this. So let's analyze this, because you can just say on the surface this is a really stupid thing and stop right there, but there are a number of components that are worth analyzing. And I should add that recently some women reporters have been fighting back by trying to engage their assailants in conversation, which is probably not what was expected by the people yelling the phrase. Some reporters have reported aborting interviews when seeing a group of young men nearby, obviously readying to interrupt her as soon as she starts. So we could say, with any kind of expression, I think one of the things to ask is there a purpose? And I really think this is an example of something, and the internet seems to encourage these things, but they certainly didn't. They certainly existed before the internet was invented. It seems to be something that doesn't really have a purpose except, you know, drawing attention to yourself. You can't think of anything intelligent to say, how about FHITP? That leads us to the question of creativity. There are some things that are purposeless, but are also creative. In fact, there's a lot of things. People like doing things that don't really have any particular purpose. I mean, that's what a game is. But they might be creative. Somebody might enjoy drawing and really doesn't ever want anybody to see their work, just has a notebook and draws things. And there's no real reason for them to do this, but it's obviously creative. But in this case, when you're yelling a phrase that you saw on YouTube, and you're not even modifying a word in the phrase, unless you don't remember the whole thing, I would say that on a creativity, it scores a 0 out of 10. Then there's a question of bravery. Is this a brave thing to run up to a reporter to break etiquette? Because obviously, if you're in a public space and you see somebody doing something that requires concentration, you have to break some etiquette to go up and disrupt whatever it is that they're doing. Whether it's a parent trying to quiet an upset child, or somebody tying their shoes, the normal etiquette is that you leave them alone to get on with what they're doing, even though they're in a public space. Perhaps there once was a game of pushing people over who were tying their shoes or something, which would seemingly have about as much purpose as FHITP. But is it brave to break etiquette? I would say it's not really brave. It's really cowardly, especially given that this appears to be only done for women reporters. I haven't heard of any cases of this being done for a man. There may be a variety of reasons for that, but given that many people, women are generally smaller and perhaps seen as less threatening, I don't think that makes you braver. Would people run up to a 250-pound male reporter and say the same thing if they were not even half the size? So I'm not sure that it's brave, and also when you're picking on a reporter, you kind of know that they're going to behave themselves, so it's highly unlikely that they're going to do anything crazy. So I don't think on the bravery scale it gets more than a 1 or a 2. Is it sexist? Well, given that it only picks on women, I think that's an easy decision to make. This is a very sexist activity. It's only picking on women. And I think that we could see that if it was only to pick on reporters who were gay or Jewish or Muslim or black, that it would also be some kind of ist, racist or something like that. It's a public space, usually, so on that note, is it possible to say anything you want in a public space? And I think really the world works better if we somewhat control what we say in a public space. But there are times when it's justified to break etiquette, and I think this gets back to the sense of purpose. There's a lot that can be criticized about the mainstream media, and women reporters as well as men reporters are generally paid by the mainstream media, which avoids talking about a lot of issues. So it would be fair game to interrupt a reporter perhaps interviewing a sports figure and ask them why they're not covering some of the important social issues. Why is it that they've never had somebody on their show who's opposed to war, but they've had lots of people who are in favor of war? There's a lot of valid criticisms that could be leveled at the mainstream media. It's hard to get on the air, so it wouldn't. It would be understandable if somebody broke etiquette by saying something important about the mainstream media, but of course FHITP doesn't qualify for that. Let's think a little bit more about the people who are doing this. Generally young men, often they've been at a sports game or some other event where they've been drinking and their inhibitions have lowered. I think it shows that they either have a great deal of ignorance about anatomy, because although people have tried to sexualize most orifices on the human body, the urethra is very narrow, and so perhaps this is saying something about the size of their penis. I don't know. Either they don't know anything about anatomy, or they've got some problems in their own anatomy. But I think it perhaps says something about the feeling of powerlessness that many young people have, and this is perhaps a way to assert their feeling of having some power in the world, even though they're using their power in a very negative way. Perhaps in this way it's a little bit like graffiti. Often graffiti is nothing more than somebody's tag, essentially their signature. And what's that really saying? It's saying, I exist. I am an individual. It would be nice if we could find ways for everybody in this world to feel that they were validated as an individual and that they felt they had worth. I wonder how many of these young men really feel that they are worthwhile as an individual. In the Charlie Hebdo case, and forgive me for bringing this up one more time, some people say that Charlie Hebdo were a group of equal opportunity satirists, and they definitely did satirize things other than Mohammed and the Muslim religion. Others say that that's true, but they focused a lot on Islam and Mohammed and the Muslim religion, perhaps because in France it occupies a relatively low position in society, position of a lack of power. Let's imagine that in this crazy FHITP world, one of the women reporters pulled out a gun and shot the man who yelled this. I think just about everybody would say, "Well, that's an overreaction. How can you kill somebody just because they did something stupid? All that came out of that young man's mouth were words, and now you're going to kill them." And I think we could all say that would be a horrible overreaction, although we could understand the anger of that reporter, who maybe had experienced this phenomenon multiple times, had interviews ruined, had become very upset sometimes because it seemed impossible to get their work done. But there's a question of balance. In Charlie Hebdo, everybody can say that the men who decided, the angry young Muslims who decided that they wanted to resort to killing, everybody can agree that that's wrong. But can we understand the anger and frustration of Muslims in France who felt that their religion was being demeaned, that they were being demeaned, and that they had a legitimate concern for their own safety because the demonization of Muslims in France has led to violence against Muslims. They may feel that they don't have equal opportunities getting a job. There are consequences to picking on a minority and picking on stereotypes, exaggerating stereotypes of that religion. In In one of the cases in Canada where a reporter did push back on this, one of the young men was identified and quickly lost his job, which was with an electricity company. Obviously, we can say he was not a bright spark. He also later apologized, although we can wonder how sincere the apology was. It's almost certainly true that he never would have apologized if he hadn't suddenly experienced some pretty severe consequences for what he did. Another of the young men in the same situation has an employer who's investigating their behavior. Some people would say this is too harsh for somebody that was just exercising their freedom of speech. Other people would say that this is actually harassment. I think we can all agree that free speech at some point can result in harassment. I remember seeing a man in a public park who was setting tiles. I don't know what this was for, but he was very carefully setting ceramic tiles, making kind of a miniature bridge in the middle of this park. How easy would it have been to just go along while the tiles were still wet and then move them around? It wouldn't have done any long-term damage, but it would have ruined his work, and it would have forced him to go back and redo all the tiles, remeasure, get the level out again. It would obviously be an annoying thing, and something that most people would say was stupid and without purpose. Let's go to Garland, Texas, where recently at a contest held by the Pamela Geller's American Freedom Defense Initiative, there was a cartoon drawing contest, a cartoon of Muhammad drawing contest with a $10,000 prize. Again, here we have two Islamic fundamentalists pulling out a gun and shooting. In this case, luckily they didn't kill anybody, but they themselves were killed by police or police who were on site. Again, we have to think a little bit more deeply about this. The American Freedom Defense Initiative is very anti-Islamic, and the Southern Poverty Law Center has called it a hate group. What's the purpose of this drawing contest? What is the purpose of drawing cartoons of Muhammad to assert free speech and not having the cartoon, the contest open to drawing any offensive cartoon? I mean, why not have people drawing cartoons that would be offensive to Jews or black people or gays and lesbians or women? Why restrict the cartoon contest to something that will be offensive to Muslims? If freedom of speech is an equal opportunity, then surely there should be an equal opportunity in who you decide that you want to offend. But Pamela Geller just wanted you to draw a cartoon that would offend Muslims. One of their keynote speakers was Geert Wilders, a very right-wing Dutch politician. There's an irony here, a very big irony, because Geert Wilders has called for the Koran to be banned. This was back in 2007. So if it's freedom of speech, and we insist that we should be able to draw cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad whenever we want to, even if it's offensive to some people, how do these free speech advocates get off on banning a book that some people value? You wonder, is it really all about free speech, or is it all related to free speech bashing Muslims, and really the free speech has not much to do with it? Again, I think we can all agree that going over to this cartoon drawing contest with a gun and starting to shoot was wrong. It was also counterproductive. I mean, not only did these people get themselves killed, but it generated a lot of sympathy and attention for Pamela Geller's organization, which probably, if it was ignored, would eventually go away, because most people would see it as offensive. But once you start shooting at people, then they are seen to be brave, advocates of freedom of speech, and maybe they're right in what they're saying. it also implies, it also seems to be proof that all Muslims are violent, because whenever something like this happens and somebody gets shot, there might be a billion Muslims in the world, but the one or two that pull out a gun are the proof that the entire religion is violent, and therefore that such contests are necessary. Not all forms of expression involve talking or writing. A form of expression that's common in the United States is to assert the right to bear arms. And somebody sent me an interesting video today in which a white guy and a black guy both decided to walk down the street to assert their right to bear arms with an AR-15, one of those semi-automatic assault rifles. And the white guy was handled amazingly politely by a policeman who asked what I thought were quite intelligent questions. Why are you doing this? And the answer basically was to assert my right to do it. So the right to bear arms kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm going to walk down the street with a rifle for which I cannot think of any use on the street of a normal town because I have the right to do it. Predictably and sadly, when the black guy tried to do the same thing, he ended up on the ground in the road, surrounded by policemen, because he was seen as a threat, a black man with a gun, although he was doing the same thing. But that's not really my message, although that's clearly an important point in other places. But I want to go back to what the policeman said. Why are you doing this? What is your purpose in expressing yourself? And I think the same question can be asked of the people who want to F you in the pisser. Why are you saying this? Are you saying it just to assert your right to say it because you can't think of anything else? Because you want to do it in public? Because you want to get a reaction? Certainly if somebody was walking in the woods with a gun, one would imagine and hope that they were off hunting. And maybe if they're driving with a gun in their car, they're off to the farm or they're off to the rifle range. One can see that in those cases, if you have a right to bear arms and you have a license if it's necessary, or you've passed the background check if that's necessary, then one can see that asserting your right to do it because you're going to go and do something legitimate with as your form of expression is one thing. But to just express yourself because you have the right to express yourself seems rather futile. And what would that mean in the language of writing and speaking? People could say really awful things that would really upset other people just because they have the right to say those things. Just as in my town in Canada, if you walked down the street with an assault rifle, you would scare a lot of people. It would have an impact on those people, a negative impact, in order to assert your right to do that, which in Canada you don't have. But I would imagine that a lot of people in America would be scared at the sight of a man walking down the street with an assault rifle. How do they know that he's not one of the NRA's famous bad guys with a gun? And is there going to be a good guy with a gun, and pretty soon there's going to be bullets flying all over the place? Expression, whether it's speaking or writing or carrying a gun, does have consequences for other people apart from the person asserting their right. But let's turn to an example of freedom of expression that has a purpose. Recently, the KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley, California, decided that a program by Bonnie Faulkner, which regularly appears, would be censored, not allowed on the air, because it included Gary Null, mostly because of Gary's views about vaccines and HIV/AIDS. And as you probably know, Gary is the founder of PRN.FM, the radio station on which this show appears. Perhaps I have a little bit of a conflict of interest. It's certainly not financial because I do this radio show without receiving any pay from Gary or his network. And the reason I agreed to have a radio show on PRN.FM is because I admire the work that Gary has done. That doesn't mean that I agree with everything he's ever done or said. But I agree that overall, he has a lot of knowledge about health and alternative health modalities. And he has been one of the few voices that has been open on problems with vaccination and the HIV/AIDS dogma. So I'd like to read a little bit from a letter that he wrote to a Ms. Prives, who I believe is a station manager at KPFA, the person who censored him. Lewis Hill, the founder of Pacifica, would have been appalled at the blatant censorship imposed upon Bonnie Faulkner and myself, especially in light of the California Senate's recent passage of a bill that destroys Californians' freedom of health choices for their children. Had I been allowed the opportunity to present the independent science opposing Big Pharma's spurious claims for vaccine efficacy and safety, there might have been enough support from KPFA listeners to have delayed or thwarted the bill's sponsors from passing it. The bill SB 277 got through the California legislature because most ordinary citizens have believed what has been said about vaccine efficacy and safety, and they have not seen big side effects in their own children so far. It wouldn't take very long, as one of my previous guests, Dr. Jane Donegan, in the previous show, as he said, it doesn't take very long to go on and see that there are big problems with vaccine efficacy and safety. And just because it might only be one out of a million children whose lives are destroyed by vaccines, either they die or they regress to a state that I have seen documented a number of times of permanent infancy, unable to talk, without bowel control, with numerous other health problems. Even if it's only one out of a million, I think parents still have a right to consider whether the vaccine, each individual vaccine, is in the best interests of their child. And by censoring commentators who have scientific knowledge, as Gary does, and as a number of other people do, censoring those people prevents the ordinary person from getting the education, from getting the other information that, even if they don't believe it, maybe is a stimulus to go and do some of their own research. And even if your research is limited to the scientific literature, there are enough papers with problems relating to vaccines, the individual components of the vaccines, regarding their effectiveness and their safety, that after a short time, many people who got the opportunity to listen to a radio program or read an article that was critical of vaccines, many people might do their own research and come to the conclusion that they need to be more careful when it comes to vaccines, and that consider each vaccine on its own merits and assert their right to have that vaccine or not, to have it for themselves or for their children. And here again, we're talking about rights. Here's a very important right that people should not allow to be taken away from them. I mean, if I had a choice between having the right to carry a gun down the street or to choose whether my children were vaccinated, I would choose the vaccination right. Luckily, we don't have to trade off rights. But here we've got a case where politicians dare not take away gun rights from people, but they have no problem taking away the rights for parents to control the vaccines that are injected into the arms of their children. And I think that it won't be long before the right is asserted by big medicine, by big pharma, to control the medicines that children have. There are actually quite a few cases where children have essentially been forced to have medications for attention deficit disorder or other things. Gary goes on to say, For those who state that I am a so-called AIDS denier, that is a blatant lie, as well as being a term slyly fabricated by pharmaceutical industry PR consultants to stigmatize those with alternative viewpoints by subliminally linking them to Holocaust deniers. I worked with one of America's leading gay physicians, Dr. Stephen Caissa, for many years. Together we counseled more than 1,200 persons with full-blown AIDS, many of whom, instead of dying as predicted, are still alive today. The term AIDS denier is quite clever because it does, of course, bring to mind the term Holocaust denier, people who denied that in the Second World War the Nazis killed Jews and gypsies and socialists and trade union members and whoever they decided they didn't like. Who's doing the denying and what are they denying? And is denial a bad thing? If somebody accused you of murder and you actually had killed somebody, then your denial is a bad thing. I didn't kill her, but you actually did. But let's say that you were accused of murder and you hadn't actually killed somebody, and you deny that you killed that person, well then, that's a good thing. You're telling the truth. And so if AIDS, quote, deniers deny that there is a connection between HIV and AIDS, if that is the truth, then there's nothing wrong with denial. But a lot of the denial occurs on the other side. People who believe in the HIV-AIDS dogma deny that there are any problems with that dogma. But there are problems. For example, HIV is believed to kill CD4 immune cells. But nobody has ever come up with a scientifically supported theory about how HIV kills CD4 cells. And if we don't know how HIV kills CD4 cells, we don't know that if it does, that it does. And if HIV doesn't kill CD4 cells, then how does it cause immune suppression? In one study, I think from the 80s or 90s, from a long time ago, they found, it was from the 80s, they found that only about 1 out of 10,000 CD4 cells were infected with HIV. So how could HIV possibly cause immune suppression when CD4 cells are replenished on a daily basis? There's no way with such a small leak in the tap that you could ever deplete the number of CD4 cells. All the body would need to do would be to minusculely increase the rate at which it produced CD4 cells, and there would be no difference to the immune system. It's often said that it's proven that HIV is sexually transmitted, and yet a lot of the evidence, most notably the 1997 Padian study, are that HIV is not sexually transmitted. And even if we try to define the terms, what does HIV mean? Well, it basically means the result of an antibody test, which means that in HIV, unlike other diseases, it's believed that an antibody can tell whether you're currently infected. Whereas with most other diseases, antibodies are believed to be preserved in your body after the virus has been defeated. What if that was the case with HIV? So the HIV antibody test is telling you that you were exposed to HIV. As Dr. Luc Montagnier has said, you can be exposed to HIV many, many times, but if you have a healthy immune system, you won't be infected. But maybe you'll develop antibodies. And then what does the term AIDS mean? Back in 1981, it meant two different diseases. PCP pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma, a skin disorder, possibly a cancer. Some people dispute that. By 1987, it was about 30 different diseases. In 1993, America added a low CD4 count without any AIDS-defining disease, but possibly without any disease at all, as a definition of AIDS. So now in America, you have the majority of people diagnosed with AIDS without an AIDS-defining condition, in many cases, perfectly healthy people, but nowhere else in the world. And in Africa, the definition is basically fever, cough, diarrhea, weight loss, itchy rash, often in the absence of an HIV test or using a rapid HIV test, which is a standard that would not be accepted in North America or Europe. So the AIDS establishment is denying that all these problems with the AIDS theory exist. but they do exist, and they should not be denied. And myself, and I'm sure Gary, will continue to deny that the connection between HIV and AIDS is proven until it is proven. Gary continued, while serving as the director of the Tri-State Healing Center, I arranged for over 1,000 persons with AIDS to be treated at no charge by physicians using holistic protocols. I published a series of articles about natural, non-toxic therapeutic protocols for helping AIDS patients. All this work led eventually to a national press conference in New York City. The conference featured 100 AIDS victims who were in full recovery or had completely reversed their conditions as demonstrated by their physicians and medical records. New York's future governor and an eminent panel of scientists reviewed the records of these patients and concluded that the results were both astonishing and significant and deserved a public hearing. During this six-hour event, each person told his story. 88 AIDS survivors explained how their physicians used detoxification modalities, Louise Hayes methods, and other metabolic therapies. The remaining 12 reversed all their illnesses and their diagnosis reversed to HIV negative under my care. However, not a single AIDS group, medical doctor, or major media member attended the conference. It was a complete and deliberate media blackout, even though thousands of invitations had been sent out. The public relations firm that handled the event reported back that they had never seen anything like that before. Now, if that's not denial, I don't know what it is. We will close our eyes and we will not listen to people. We will not look at people who claim that any of the AIDS conditions, which is about, as I mentioned before, about 30 different diseases, we will deny that any of them can be treated in any way other than antiretroviral drugs. Of course, if you're not HIV positive, all 30 conditions can occur in people who are HIV negative. In those cases, we would recommend a different treatment. We would recommend a treatment that is specific for those conditions. But in many cases, the disease that go under the AIDS diseases that go under the AIDS umbrella, things like a bacterial and fungal infections, they indicate a problem in the body, an imbalance in the body that could be due to malnutrition, the use of injection drugs, or the use of recreational drugs, injection or not. Basically, it could indicate a seriously unhealthy lifestyle. And so alternative health, and I'm not really an advocate of alternative health, except that I recognize that first of all, it recognizes that you need to change your lifestyle. You can't really use alternative health protocols if you continue to do poppers three times a week, if you're consuming excessive quantities of alcohol, if you're not sleeping properly, if you never get any exercise. There's no point in using alternative therapies under those conditions. Secondly, alternative therapies have been proven to bring about slow and gradual improvements in health. And, very importantly, they're almost all non-toxic. So it's very unusual for somebody to be damaged by an alternative health protocol. There have been cases of contamination and things like that. Whereas with mainstream pharmaceuticals, back in 1998, there was a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association that documented 106,000 Americans a year were estimated to be killed by properly prescribed pharmaceuticals given in hospitals. That didn't include pharmaceuticals prescribed outside the hospital setting, such as in nursing homes, in mental institutions, through a doctor's office, over the counter at a pharmacy. It didn't include improper prescriptions. This could be the wrong drug, the wrong dosage of the drug delivered in the wrong way, a compound not mixed properly. There's just so many things that could go wrong. It didn't include hospital-acquired infections, surgical errors, things like that. Gary Null, after that paper came out, with assistance of a couple of other people, put together a list of some of the other consequences of mainstream medication and estimated that it was about 1 million Americans a year who were killed by the medical system that denies that there are useful alternatives, particularly in the area of AIDS, but also in the area of cancer and mental illness. There's very little acceptance that there are other ways to treat the conditions, not other drugs, but other ways to treat the conditions. And in many ways, many times, it doesn't involve drugs at all, particularly for, say, mental health problems. Gary continues, I worked closely with Charles Ortleb, the editor of the nation's number one gay publication at that time, New York Native. It was the opinion of the Native's award-winning journalist, Nina Ostrom, that AIDS was due to multiple causes, including the herpes 6 virus, HHV-6. Charles Ortleb, Nina Ostrom, and others appeared on my radio programs frequently to present their firsthand experiences and investigations that differed from those of the emerging gay faction that became aligned with and to a great extent financed by the medical industry. Recently, on a program with Gary Null, we talked about what happened to ACT UP. At first, it was purely an organization that was gay men trying to save the lives of other gay men, and its motives were pure. But once pharmaceutical money came into the picture, they had to decide whether they would get onto the pharmaceutical bandwagon and demand that pharmaceutical drugs were the solution, which some people did, or continue looking at alternative health, lifestyle changes, things like that. Since all the money went into the faction that went with the pharmaceutical industry, it grew, and the other portion fell away. So basically, in the gay community, if you're going to talk about HIV and AIDS, you're talking about which drug to take. You're not talking about alternatives, because there simply aren't very many organizations that provide that anymore. Gary continues, Burroughs Wellcome, which is now GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturer of AZT, was one of the largest funders of individuals in the AIDS movement, such as ACT UP, who targeted myself and other journalists and activists who questioned the belief that AIDS could only be treated with antiviral drugs, such as they manufactured and sold at predatory markups as high as literally 2,000% and more. AZT is a very toxic compound, but it was developed by the U.S. government, I believe in the 1960s, as a cancer treatment and put on the shelf for reasons that aren't entirely clear, but it was not effective as a cancer drug. It was taken off the shelf by Burroughs Wellcome, which didn't pay for the development of the drug, and then sold at a massive markup. I'm still not exactly sure how they pulled off this trick, but they had an exclusive market from 1987 when AZT was approved in rapid and probably quite corrupt FDA trials. There at least couldn't have been a good analysis of AZT because it was accepted so quickly. Also in Charles Ortleb's newspaper, The Nation, John Lauritsen asserted his right to free speech and his right to access to information. And although he was denied a lot of information about the AZT trials, he found more than enough to show that the trials themselves were highly corrupt. And if the AZT trials are corrupt, then what was there? There was a toxic drug known to cause severe anemia and many, many other side effects. We had a toxic drug that might not actually do anybody any good. But the panic was so great, and the lack of unbiased information was so great, that the drug companies basically succeeded. They still sell AZT in the third world or in combination with other drugs. And now they have new drugs that are also sold at predatory markups. It's hard to believe that drugs can really cost anywhere close to the $20,000 a year that it costs many people to pay for their AIDS drugs. It's not a cost borne by the individual. It's usually borne by governments, because no ordinary person could afford that much in a drug that also eliminates your ability in many cases to work at a job because the side effects are so severe. Continuing with Gary's letter, as the death toll rose parallel to higher AZT doses, the pharmaceutical industry and ACT UP continued to promote the pharmaceutical approach to treating AIDS. even though it was not curing, but instead killing off thousands of the afflicted. As a result, we witnessed a tragic mass die-off of those using high doses of retrovirals. In order to silence those of us, physicians, scientists, journalists, and activists, straight or gay, who spent thousands of hours trying to bring this deadly misapplication of drugs to public attention, a smear campaign was launched to call us AIDS denialists, which continues today. This was intended to produce an effect similar to calling someone a Holocaust denier, and it destroyed people's careers. Today, there are over 3,000 scientists, researchers, and multiple Nobel laureates who challenge the existing AIDS paradigm. None of them deny AIDS as an illness. Instead, what they request is an open debate about other methods of diagnosis and treatment that have proved both effective and safe, but do not rely on dangerous drugs. And that is why the pharmaceutical industry works so hard to stigmatize those, such as myself, and this is Gary talking, who are a threat to their huge profit machine, since research into HIV and AIDS today is larger than that for cancer and cardiovascular disease combined. It's quite remarkable that the amount of money the United States government spends on HIV and AIDS is increased by approximately $1 billion each year, and is now over $30 billion. That's not the total funding since the very beginning of AIDS till today. That's going to be $30 billion in 2015. And in 2016, it'll be $31 billion. I don't know how long this is going to go on. The problem is that pharmaceutical companies not only demand large profits, but they demand that their profits increase every year, because otherwise the shareholders will be unhappy. And how do you get the profits to increase every year? Well, you either get more people to take your drugs, you get people to take more of your drugs, or you increase the profit margin on your drugs. But this is a treadmill that has to come to an end. There are an increasing number of people who refuse to take any drugs except under the most dire of circumstances. And they're running out of people that they can persuade to take their toxic compounds. Plus, in cases like AIDS, they kill off many of the people who take their drugs. So this all has to come to an end, and I predict that the end will be surprisingly rapid. That the collapse of a theory like AIDS might occur in only a couple of years. We will go from dogmatic belief in the HIV-AIDS dogma. Well, I guess that's redundant. We will go to a universal, almost universal belief in the HIV-AIDS dogma to an almost universal disbelief only in a matter of a few years, because it will have reached a point of no return, that the problems with the theory will be so obvious and the drug companies will realize that the game is over. But of course, what they will try to do is to come up with something else to fill the gap in their profits. Either that or big segments of the pharmaceutical industry are going to collapse. I'll read one more small part about this letter. Regrettably, censorship such as yours at KPFA helps shut off public and open debate on the dangers of unsafe vaccines, as well as on alternative treatments for AIDS. And your statements attacking me as an AIDS denialist by listening to disturbed propagandists flies in the face of simple fact-checking. I have repeatedly invited my attackers on the KPFK and WBAI programs in the past to debate me, but they refused. However, on my program, I did debate the two most prominent people in the field of AIDS, Drs. Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier, the latter of which won the Nobel Prize in 2008 for first identifying HIV. Gary's experience is similar to mine. I would love to debate those that hold the HIV theory as a dogma, the HIV-AIDS theory as a dogma. It's very difficult to even talk to people, and when you do talk, they will just throw dogmatic statements at you, they will assert status, they will do anything to actually avoid getting down and dirty in the debate and actually talking about the science and trying to explain things, and where they can't explain things, admitting that there are a few flaws in the HIV-AIDS theory. The same is true of the vaccine issue. I have not seen a lot of criticism in the mainstream media about vaccines for a long time, but this year, 2015, things got a whole lot worse. A good illustration was in Canada's Toronto Star, Canada's largest circulation daily newspaper, had published an article that documented that a number of young women, after the HPV vaccine, had experienced a serious decline in their health. And it even says on the label of these vaccines that they can cause things like Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is paralysis. This was published in the newspaper and, of course, got some pushback from doctors and vaccine advocates. But it probably would have survived if it hadn't been for the measles epidemic, which caused a complete assertion of total censorship in the mainstream media. And I have no idea how this was accomplished. But what I observed, I don't know how it happened, what I observed was that any discussion, any negative discussion of vaccines was completely shut down starting about January of this year. The Toronto Star article was caught in the sights of the vaccine industry, and within a few weeks it was withdrawn by the newspaper, even though the article had not said that there was a definite connection between the health decline and the vaccine. We're not allowed to talk about things like a child receiving a vaccine and the same day becoming seriously ill. It's true that just because A follows B, that it doesn't prove that B was the cause. But when you have multiple similar stories, it starts to develop a pattern. And if nobody can come up with an alternative explanation, then by Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is to say that it was the vaccine. I'd like to finish this show by talking about a completely different subject, but also one that involves the assertion of the right to speak, which is Seymour Hersh's recent article on the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Seymour Hersh, as many people know, came to fame because he broke the story on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam in the 1960s. He's not been somebody that the American military-industrial complex has loved. He's offended a lot of people who have powerful vested interests in selling more weapons. And so where would we be without people like Seymour Hersh, who take the right of free speech seriously? I think that most people would grudgingly admit that Seymour Hersh tries very hard to validate his sources, that he would never invent a source, and that although he may make some mistakes or publish things that later prove to be untruths, overall the vast majority of what he's written has proven to be true. It is also true that powerful interests in any government, whether it's the American government or another government, lie to us on a regular basis. And in the case of the Osama bin Laden story, since the story changed several times before it was finally solidified, it's pretty clear that we were being lied to, at least at first. So in Seymour Hersh's article, he stated that there was no resistance when the SEALs went into the Osama bin Laden compound, that they knew there was going to be no resistance, and I'll get to that in a little bit, and that their intent was to assassinate Osama bin Laden. So what President Obama said about they would have arrested him and brought him to trial if they could have taken him alive couldn't have been true, because there was nobody shooting back. The article also says that they did not find bin Laden by following his courier, but by a tip from someone within the Pakistani intelligence service anxious to get the $25 million reward. This also means that the story about the vaccine program, the fake vaccine program which was designed to get Osama bin Laden's DNA, was actually cover-up. It was to cover up Pakistani cooperation. So how did Pakistani cooperation happen? Well, according to Seymour Hersh, the Americans realized it would be difficult to get in into Pakistani airspace reliably with helicopters to perform the operation. So they confronted the Pakistanis with the information that they were holding Osama bin Laden under house arrest, and that the Americans knew this. The Pakistanis cooperated as long as, of course, it was secret, and the outside world thought that the Pakistanis had been taken unawares. The article also says that Osama bin Laden was not buried at sea, and that there had been a cover story prepared that would say that Osama bin Laden had been killed by a drone, but this cover story had to be abandoned when a U.S. helicopter crashed the compound, making it impossible to hide the fact that something big was going down. Seymour Hersh also asserted that there was no big cache of documents, that the SEALs grabbed a few papers. And if Osama bin Laden really was under house arrest, which is what Seymour Hersh is saying, then there probably weren't any documents of significance, and there weren't couriers going in and out of the building because the Pakistanis had Osama bin Laden where they wanted him. The response of the media is what I'm really interested in. These are quite shocking allegations, even to people who are used to being lied to by their governments. And one would naturally expect some skepticism on the part of mainstream media, but there appears to be an almost full-scale denial that there could possibly be anything valid in this reporting. And a lot of the criticisms aren't really criticisms when you get right down to it. People have criticized Seymour Hersh for using anonymous sources, but in Washington, D.C., that's a normal practice when it comes to the military-industrial complex. You don't get people at the CIA to speak on the record very often. This is what we need in this world, is people like Seymour Hersh and Gary Null, and perhaps even myself, who have a purpose in asserting the right to free speech. And I hope that you have enjoyed this episode of The Infectious Myth, and I hope you will join me on future episodes. Keep asserting your right to the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, but always make sure that you have a good purpose in what you're doing. Enjoy your week. Goodbye.